Call case 85590, Fred v. District Court. Counsel, you state your appearances, please.
John Ford, McDonald Toronto, with the Attorney's Jane Sussman.
Good morning.
Benjamin Johnson, Senior Deputy District Attorney of Carson City.
All right. Good morning. Everybody ready to proceed? All right, Mr. Fortin, are you going to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, Chief Justice.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Whenever you're ready to proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Stiglitz, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is John Fortin of McDonald Toronto, and we represent the petitioner, Mr. Elvin Fred. Elvin comes to this court seeking extraordinary relief from an extraordinary wrong. The state already took Elvin's home, left his family homeless, destroyed the property, and now seeks to violate his inalienable property and double jeopardy rights. This separate proceeding seeks to impose a second punishment for the exact same criminal conduct that Elvin already pleaded guilty to and has already served 8 years of his criminal sentence this week.
There. And have you addressed the distinction between in personam and in rem?
Thank you, Chief Justice Perigary. In personam.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Sorry. No, you go ahead.
So the in personam and in rem jurisdiction we don't think is applicable at this point because 1173 subsection 9 ties the jurisdiction to the criminal conviction. If you look throughout 1173, the district court must stay the proceedings until there's a criminal conviction. If there's a not guilty, the proceeding must end and the property must be returned within 7 days. There cannot be a property forfeiture absent a criminal conviction. Did that cover the...
Not necessarily. I think it's a little deeper than that, too.
So certainly, if we look at what we're asking this court to do, which is establish a Nevada-specific test for property forfeitures, we're asking this court to do what courts have done for centuries, which is to determine what is punishment. And we think
as an usury, let's look at that case in particular. Why is this so much different than usury?
2 points, Your Honor. First and foremost, Article 1, Section 1 of Nevada's Constitution provides an inalienable property right that, as this court said in Sisolak, is wholly absent from the federal Constitution. Secondly, the usury test would ask this court to concede significant power, namely conceding to the legislature its intent, meaning that the legislature could craft statutes in order to avoid constitutional rights. This court just 2 years ago, with the legislature as a party, before this court in the Settlemyer decision, said that as it interpreted the supermajority provision and as the LCB provided an analysis, that this court gets to say what the Constitution means, not what the legislature means. And so both prongs of usury would require this court to revisit significant precedent that we haven't seen a change since Settlemyer specifically, since Nevada Yellow Cab, the Bahabel decision that Justice Pickering wrote. And so that's a core distinction in that this court should say what the Constitution means. It shouldn't let the legislature draft a statutory scheme.
I'd like to follow up on a point that Justice Perigary raises, though, and that is the precedent here in the in rem jurisdiction. We have the Levinston 2 case, which is an opinion of this court that followed usury, and the court quite clearly said that NRS Chapter 179 applies the rules of civil procedure to forfeiture actions, defines the parties as plaintiff and claimant, and provides that a forfeiture proceeding is an in rem proceeding. And that is independent of the test for that you're advocating. There nonetheless is a finding by this court, not more like 25 years ago, that this is an in rem proceeding, and so the dual punishment collapses if that's true. And I think that's the point that Justice Perigary was making.
Certainly.
So I'm still troubled by that because it's not only inconsistent with usury, but also with our own precedent as to the characterization of what a forfeiture proceeding in Nevada entails.
Certainly, and I take your point, Justice Pickering, but Levingston 2 came back to this court on a petition for rehearing following Erzurri's announcement. Levingston 1 occurred before Erzurri was announced, and the court applied Halper, and it applied several federal constitutional decisions, and this court applied federal constitutional decisions. This court has never addressed Nevada's constitution, and Justice Perigary, in Wilson, you specifically said that the double jeopardy clause under the federal constitution has retreated while the Nevada constitution has become broader. This court can look at its takings context, it can look at search and seizure context, it can look at the right of a cause of action that just a few months ago this court said that Nevadans possess a private right of action. So this court is certainly capable of and has deviated from the federal constitution. But again, Justice Pickering, when Levingston was decided, subsections 9 and 10 were not existent in the code. And that is the question that this court must grapple with. What happens when you have specifically tied the punishment? I mean, I don't think there's anybody in this courtroom that could keep a straight face and say that the loss of a home for a criminal conviction is punishment. And so when you tie the criminal conviction to the punishment, double jeopardy arises. And we're not saying that the state cannot enact and obtain property forfeitures. What we're saying is when it musters that punishment, it must do so in one proceeding. That's what Nevada's constitution says. And I want to bring the court and think about...
Let me ask you a question, because a moment ago you talked about your view that the Nevada constitution through the courts has become broader. And you kind of seem to say that from a 30,000-foot view. But what about just with regard to the double jeopardy clause of the Nevada Constitution? How is that different from the federal clause dealing with the same thing, such that usury somehow doesn't apply if we use that logic?
I think Justice Perigary's decision in Wilson separated out the two, where under the federal constitution, if you obtain a remand because of some error in the district court proceeding, that the ceiling of your liberty and your sentence cannot be increased following that second proceeding. And this court said that that core constitutional right of liberty is broader under Nevada's constitution.
Well,
we're not.
Well, and again, I'm not sure that fits perfectly with this particular situation. We've always recognized that we can afford more rights under the Nevada constitution than under the federal constitution. But I don't think that's an absolute in every case we look at that we have to expand.
Certainly, Justice Perigary, but I would ask this court to look at the rich history, tradition, and precedent of Nevada protecting property rights. In the 1978 Chevrolet case, as this court evaluated NRS 453, it incorporated founding era precedent in which property forfeitures were disfavored and reasonable doubt was imposed. The legislature is not free to manipulate this court's precedent on one hand in order to lower double jeopardy's protections on the other. And so I'm not saying that there's always going to be punishment when the state acts, but it is interesting that when liberty is at issue, we have heightened protections. Why is it when we have property protections, we don't have heightened protections? That's the core of what we're talking about today.
Well, back up for a moment here. Liberty and property are two distinctly different things. When you talk about why do we have what we have in place when we're talking about a person's freedom from incarceration versus a forfeiture of a piece of property, we have to look at that differently.
I would argue, Your Honor, that you can't have liberty if you do not have property. Being homeless in this country is incredibly difficult. And so it would be difficult to say that you can exercise all of your liberty without property. But what I want to point this court to is that the state's authority to forfeit property comes from the criminal code. It comes only when there's a criminal conviction. And the state is the only entity that can exercise this right of action under 179. As a private litigant, I can't bring my clients into court under 179 and seek to forfeit property. Punishment, and punishment in the constitutional double jeopardy sense, has always looked at, is it a public wrong? A criminal conviction meets that. And is it a public remedy? Does the state benefit from whatever is happening? Those two things are indisputably present here because the state will profit. And as the U.S. Supreme
Court... But there are multiple policies
behind... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Chris. You go ahead.
The policies behind forfeitures, I want you to discuss that for a minute as you're getting into this issue that you're talking about now. It's more than just the state profiting, as you indicate. There's other considerations there. And when you're looking at a second prong of usury, you know, there's a whole lot of other policy considerations there.
And we don't quarrel with the policy considerations of deterrence and remediation and all of what my friends and colleagues on the other side have put in their briefing. But we're saying you have to muster that power and weight of the state in the one proceeding. Put this punishment in the criminal forfeiture context when the individual has the right to counsel and when the individual can dispute the criminal acts that has placed his liberty in jeopardy. That's what the Double Jeopardy Clause says. There can be lots of policy goals that the legislature puts into place. I imagine that when the legislature wants to build something and they need to use private property, there's probably a really good reason for that. But that doesn't mean that they don't owe just compensation when they take property. That's what we're asking this court to say here. If you're going to punish Elvin, and there's no dispute that he's been punished, he's been in prison for 8 years as of this week, and they're trying to take his home based off of the criminal conviction, not based off of a legal fiction of in rem jurisdiction, but for the criminal conviction, the state could not take his home. That's the thrust of our argument today, and punishment is not binary. It's not a flipping a light switch on and off. The court has to take a contextual analysis, look at the statutory provision, look at the policy goals. As the Supreme Court said in Timms, when the state stands to benefit, courts should take and scrutinize that action more closely. And that's what we're asking this court to do today. Unless there are further questions, I'd like to reserve my balance for rebuttal.
Do you draw a distinction between the house and, you know, $500?
No, Your Honor, we don't, because the Inalienable Property Rights Clause says property. It doesn't distinguish between real property or personal property. And that's one of the points that I hope this court makes, is that as Wilson, it looks at sentencing decisions. It doesn't look at murderers or burglars or whatnot. It looks at the sentencing decision. We're asking for property forfeitures, regardless of an instrumentality or whatnot.
So that is, in your mind, binary. That's just, if you're taking the property, then the analysis applies regardless of the value of that particular piece of property or money or anything else. And any, you take away any discretion to look at that in any difference. If it's taking it, it's punishment and it's bad.
We're not taking away the court's discretion because the excessive fines clause would come into play and courts would be analyzing the whether it's grossly disproportionate to the crime. But as a threshold jurisdictional question, which is what we're here on, we're saying the punishment of taking someone's property, their home, their car, or their $908, must be done within the same proceeding for the same offense as the text of Nevada's Constitution says. If I can preserve.
All right, thank you, Mr. Fortin.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson?
Good morning. Benjamin Johnson, Senior Deputy District Attorney of Carson City, for the record, representing the Real Party and Interest Nevada XREL Investigation Division of the Nevada Department of Public Safety, which I will refer to as TriNet. May it please the court. For over the past 36 years, the state of Nevada has followed a statutory framework created by the legislature to allow civil forfeiture of the proceeds and instrumentalities of a crime. Petitioner seeks to undo this framework despite no intervening change in state law or Supreme Court precedent upon which Nevada's civil forfeiture framework is built. The petition also asked the court to ignore the controlling test and case law for determining when a civil forfeiture violates double jeopardy and instead adopt a position that this court has already expressly disavowed.
Mr. Johnson?
Yes, Your Honor.
The U.S. Supreme Court's test in Ursary isn't binding on us as to interpreting the Nevada Constitution, is it?
No, Your Honor, but the court has adopted the test in Ursary, and so therefore this court's...
And in that case, in the Livingston 2 case where we adopted the test, that was based on a challenge under the federal constitution, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And before that test was adopted, this court had said something different, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In fact, in Livingston 1, the court had followed Ninth Circuit precedent that did say that double jeopardy was violative under the federal constitution. And then after Ursary came out, as my opposing counsel had pointed out, this court granted a petition for rehearing, redecided the case, and adopted Ursary, and thereby disavowing the, you know, its previous holding.
Under the federal constitution.
Under the federal
double
constitution.
Jeopardy clause.
That's correct.
Okay.
In addition to responding to questions from the court, I'd like to use my time to highlight some of the reasons that the petition should be denied, as well as to address some of the points in the reply. It is well established that extraordinary relief is not available when an adequate and speedy remedy exists. Petitioner has an available remedy in the form of an appeal. The relief petitioner seeks would completely upend the entire civil forfeiture scheme in Nevada. This kind of fundamental change in Nevada law should not occur in a case where there's been no evidentiary record created in the lower court.
Well, counsel, we have this fiction of, you know, proceeding against the property in rem, but it's, as counsel said, specifically contingent upon first being convicted of a crime.
Correct,
right?
Your Honor.
And so does that allow the government to evade due process protections when you can just take someone's property after they've already been punished under this kind of legal fiction of it being in rem versus in personam?
No, Your Honor, because the statute requires that a conviction occur first. And so in order to, and additionally in 2015, as opposing counsel pointed out, Nevada added protections for innocent property owners. So therefore, you have to have either have had some knowledge of the crime that's committed or be involved with the property or ownership of the property and be involved in that crime in some way. So it protects...
But you're saying it's not punishment for the crime itself?
Correct. It's a collateral... it's collateral to the punishment, but it's not punishment itself.
Well, it's contingent
no.
upon the punishment.
It's contingent
right?
upon the punishment. Right. If there's no conviction, then the property is returned to the property owner.
Do you think it makes a difference what the basis for the forfeiture is? Say, if it's proceeds versus, say, a house that was not necessarily used in criminal activity?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because they both serve the same purpose, and that the for proceeds, that the idea is that the person convicted of the crime is not going to benefit from that crime. And the in rem against the property, such as a house, is to ensure, you know, one, that like the property is not used for the further commission of crimes, and two, it serves other, you know, public purposes, such as, you know, deterring crime, and as I said, also ensuring that the, you know, the property isn't further used.
Just from a practical point, wouldn't it make more sense to do all of those things together in one proceeding?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean, the same protections would apply, and they do apply in a separate civil proceeding.
What would be the harm of doing that?
I don't necessarily see that there's a harm, but that's not how the legislature has created the statutory scheme. And the fact that it's not in one procedure doesn't render it a double jeopardy violation.
How can the fact that the legislature decides to call it civil make it civil, right? It's still a punishment for a crime, isn't it?
Well, no, because this court and the Supreme Court have said that it's not a punishment. Has said that...
But it is punishment for purposes of the excessive fines clause.
It depends. That goes to the proportionality of the argument, Your Honor, and that's not raised in this case. So whether a home is proportionate to whatever crime was committed is a separate argument than double jeopardy.
Correct. Obviously, it's a different test for whether there is a violation of that particular clause as opposed to double jeopardy. But how can it be the same civil forfeiture action be considered punishment under one clause of the Constitution and not punishment under another clause of the Constitution adopted at the same time by the same people?
Well, and I don't think that it is punishment under both. I think that it's a fact-specific, as this court has said, it's fact-specific analysis to determine whether or not, as adopted by the court, you know, first you look at what the legislative intent of the statute was, assessing that, you know, civil remedy, and then you look at, you know, whether it's so punitive, in fact, that it is a punishment. So, I think there's
so
a distinction.
Why should there be a under ursary test, there, if the legislature intends for it to be civil, which likely they did, then there's a presumption that it's not subject to double jeopardy and it's only considered a punishment if there's the clearest proof. Why should the legislative intent bring in a presumption as to a constitutional provision? I don't understand why is the legislative intent determinative when we're interpreting the Constitution?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that, you know, the legislature does have the discretion to set, you know, what the statutory scheme is. And so I think that it's not dispositive of whether or not it's punishment.
And how is this not punishment? Like, what is the purpose of taking this man's house if not to punish him for selling drugs there?
Well, Your Honor, I think, again, that would go to proportionality. You know, we don't have a fact-specific record before us. So, you know, it's hard to say how this is punishment against Mr. Fred. I mean, and in the abstract, you know, just saying that the home is, the forfeiture of a home is punishment goes against what this court adopted in Levingston 2, where there was a forfeiture of a home, and this court found that it wasn't punishment because it had been used in the trafficking of drugs.
Right, and because we were obligated to follow the U.S. Supreme Court's test as to the U.S. Constitution.
Correct.
Right. But also under the Kennedy concurrence in usury, this punishment issue is a bit of a red herring because the question is who and what is being punished. And as Kennedy noted, civil in rem forfeiture is not punishment of the wrongdoer for his criminal offense. It is that the property was used in criminal activity, which is a different concept. So the property is being forfeited because it was put to that use. I get that that test is subject to criticism on a policy basis, but is it unconstitutional?
I would argue not, Your Honor. You know, this court has followed closely federal precedent when it comes to applying Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, as noted in the briefing. We've pointed out specifically one instance where this court has found that Nevada's Double Jeopardy Clause provides greater protection than the federal Constitution. Petitioners don't cite any examples other than, as Justice said earlier, you know, a 30,000-point view where, you know, the Nevada Constitution provides greater protections, but doesn't cite any specific examples of where that has actually been implemented by this court. It's also important to note that he does have a remedy in the form of an appeal, and this court has observed that even though it may take longer to get to that ultimate question.
I'm sorry, can we just go back for a second?
Absolutely.
So when I look at the statute, it is in a chapter called Special Proceedings of a Criminal Nature. And I appreciate that the legislature has in the statute says it's NREM, cites to the rules of civil procedure. But I really am having trouble making sense of that, right? Because it seems like if it's in a chapter that says special proceedings of a criminal nature, that it would be at least a quasi-criminal proceeding, right?
And I can't speak to, you know, the reasons why it was labeled in that chapter. I can only look at what the face of the statute says, which is what this, you know, the test in Livingston 2 and Ursary says that the court should do. So rather than looking at where it's placed in the statute or the statutory scheme as a whole, we look at specifically, you know, what the statute says. And it applies the rules of civil procedure. It calls the parties plaintiff and defendant, and it's an in rem procedure against the property itself. So, I don't know that that's dispositive.
What about the fact that the forfeiture is tied to a criminal conviction? Do you think that makes a difference?
No, because the idea is, again, that goes back to the innocent property owner protections that have adopted. So somebody that has an ownership interest in the property before the crime was committed, who doesn't have knowledge of it or didn't participate in it, is not going to be punished or, you know, sorry, not going to have their... They're not going to have their property taken away from them. I didn't mean to say punished. I apologize. But if they acquired the property after the fact, they have to prove that they had no knowledge that the crime committed. So again, I don't think that that's, the focus of the case here. I think it is important to note that the petitioner hasn't explained exactly what kind of challenge they're bringing. Whether this is a facial challenge to the entire statutory scheme or whether this is an as-applied challenge to Elvin himself. You know, he argues that his home has been taken, his family has been put out into the street, but we have no evidentiary record to support that. So I think it's important for that distinguishment. I believe that's reason enough for this court to deny the petition because it's not clear. So what remedy is the petitioner seeking? Is he seeking to undo the entire statutory scheme and, you know, find that forfeitures in general are unconstitutional? Or is it as applied to him? If it's as applied, then the appropriate course of action would be to remand this case back to the district court, allow for the creation of an evidentiary record, and then allow the case to proceed to appeal if he's unsuccessful. Petitioner argues that this is a case, a choice between Blockberger and Ursary, but as explained, this court has already said that Ursary is the appropriate test. The forfeiture cause of action is not charging a second offense against a person like in regular double jeopardy cases. Elvin is not facing a second criminal prosecution. He's not facing an extended prison sentence. It's only regarding to in rem property that was used in the commission of a crime.
Counsel, and just to clarify again, the Ursary test, as applied in Livingston 2, was because we were looking at a federal statute.
Correct.
We've not developed any test, as far as I can see, to construe the same the Nevada statute under double jeopardy. And so when you say Ursary, we've already said that Ursary is the appropriate test. We have not said that as it pertains to Nevada Constitution, correct?
Correct. But there would be no reason for you to deviate from that because Nevada's constitutional language mirrors the language in the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
It doesn't mean we're bound, even if it mirrors the language. I mean,
you're not bound, no. But the court has... You know, there's numerous examples of when this court, and, you know, incited in the petition, or sorry, in the response, where this court does follow federal jurisprudence according to the Fifth Amendment in application to Nevada's double jeopardy clause. This is distinguishable from New Mexico, where petitioner argues that Nunez should be controlling, but there's facial differences between New Mexico and Nevada. You know, it's completely different statutory framework in New Mexico. They also have additional statutes on the books that protect, if I could just finish my point, Your Honor.
Of course.
They have additional statutes that protect double jeopardy. So it's wrong to say that Nunez is applicable to this court because of the differences in the statutory language and on the face of the constitutional provisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you. The New Mexico test is good guidance for this court because of Article 1, Section 1, which New Mexico possesses and the federal constitution doesn't. And the United States Constitution and the Nevada Constitution do not mirror each other. There's life and limb, liberty, and it simply says that two offenses or two punishments for the same offense in Nevada's constitution.
Counsel, what do you say to the argument that we don't really know what you're asking us to do here? Is this an applied or a facial, as applied or a facial challenge? Are you asking us to adopt Ursary and then construe it as a criminal statute or, what is it that you're, what's the relief that you're seeking here?
We're here on an as-applied challenge. We're seeking a writ of prohibition because the district court lacks jurisdiction to punish Elvin twice for the same criminal offense. The only way, as we outline in our reply brief, for this court to adopt Ursary is to actually evaluate the other unambiguous, benign, and clearly enunciated statutory provisions that lower due process, as you pointed out, Justice Lee. But I want to bring back to Justice Kadish's point. Timms brought forth that the excessive fines clause is punishment, and courts in Nevada shall interpret the punishment that way. There's incongruity between the federal constitution and Nevada's constitution on that regard, and we're asking this court to bring congruity to that.
But what do you say to, like, there's punitive damages? They are punishment, but they're quintessentially civil.
I would bring it back to who has the power, Your Honor. And the state is the only entity that can forfeit property. The only way they can forfeit property is with a criminal conviction. It is housed in the criminal code. And just because the legislature says it's constitutional doesn't mean that this court can't say, no, it's not. And this court has done that time and time again. And that's what we're asking this court to do. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Ford. All right, this matter will stand submitted. We will be in recess.